15. Now, let's try. Apparently, it's working, which is very important. Okay, start recording. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the crypto course. Now, I would really like you to be physically present in the class, because it's very difficult for me to talk to an empty classroom, which unfortunately has happened not only to me, but to many professors. In addition, if you are present in the class, it has some advantages, especially in the exercise. Then we can help you with the tasks on site, you know. So, and it will be more fun. You will at least know each other. The things that the students in the last 2 years were missing because of the epidemic. So today we are starting with the cryptology course. Are you all master students or there are PhD students here? All master students. Okay. Then we, of course, are supposed to have some students online. We shall see if they appear. It is possible. Yes, somebody is there as well. So I hope that everybody online can hear me. If you don't, please let me know by using chat. Okay, I'll give you some technical details about the course. You have the Blackboard room for this. I hope you all have access to it. And in the directory learning materials, you already have all the lectures, exercise, literature, everything is ready, as far as I know. So if you notice anything that doesn't work or is not logical or there is an error, please let me know, then we correct that. In addition, during the lectures, if I notice that something is wrong, are corrected in the lectures, it happens, so some typographic errors, etc., etc. So, for example, topic one, classical cryptography that we are going to talk about today. We have lectures, exercises, software that you can download and run on your computers. Recordings will be there, of course. Now it's nothing there. And you have some literature that's like further reading. You are not obliged to read that for the exam. However, it may be interesting to learn, to read. And then for each of the topics, we have stream ciphers, a big topic that consists of three lectures. Block ciphers, also three lectures. And asymmetric ciphers, also three lectures. Then hash functions and digital signatures, one lecture. Yeah. So that's the whole course. And of course, there are some additional instructions. So you will see during our exercises that you will need, for example, to build this NTL library for big numbers. And then statistical test suite. We are going to do something in our exercises, how to statistically test the cryptographic sequences. So that's something that we will do in stream ciphers, block ciphers, also asymmetric ciphers, it's possible. Yeah. So that's about the technical details regarding the class. Then you have this Blackboard Collaborate. So in Blackboard Collaborate, you will have the recordings of these lectures. In these recordings, you will hear my voice and the voice of the person that will help me with the exercises. And you will see the slides or the material that is displayed on the screen. So we'll not see me and the slides at the same time. Now, we are doing other streaming and recording through this Omnom system, local system in Jovik, where you see on one side the slides and on the other screen you see me talking, which may be useful. So we are doing this in parallel because every now and then one of these systems, well, as they say in Norwegian, svikter. Oh, it fails. So we have some technical problems with the equipment, with the internet, whatever. So the probability that you will really miss the recording is reduced by doing this in parallel. The exam is 5 hours written exam. It will happen on June 9th. So you will get the details, of course, 3 days before the exam, where, in which room, etc., etc. But it will, this subject is only taught in Jovik, so all the students are supposed to be physically on the exam on June 9th. That's what I know now. So it's a 5 hours written exam. Before, we had a project and a 3 hours exam, and then there were some plans, actually by the Parliament of Norway, it was a law saying that each part of the subject that gives a mark must have two examiners, so which would require 4 examiners for this subject. So that would be too much. Then I decided to cancel this project. Now, after that, it was postponed by the government, by the new government. So for now, the situation is that it is not compulsory to have 2 examiners for each part giving the mark, but we can only make changes 1 year in advance. So if I introduce the project again, that will apply for the next generation of the students, not for you. It's technically impossible to introduce a program. It was a kind of programming project. You know? So you will not have this. You will only have a written exam. The written exam will contain some theoretical questions and some practical tasks, numerical tasks to solve. And if it will take 5 hours, it should be enough time to score well on that. So you will see. The subject is challenging in the sense that if you haven't had some mathematical background, for example, if you haven't studied mathematics, so if you are engineers, I don't know what your profiles are, but if you didn't study mathematics, some topics will be quite strange. And because of that, since it's not on the engineering programs in mathematics to learn, for example, about finite fields, etc., etc., you maybe have mentioned that in discrete mathematics, but very, very small part of that. So you will meet some concepts that may sound strange in the beginning, but I shall try to explain everything to you. Well, we shall try, because I have a TA, teaching assistant. It's Claire. She will be here at 3:15 today. It's 3:15 or 2:15 where we start the exercises. 4, 5, 7. It should be 15:15. Yeah. So you will see her, and she will also help you with the exercises. Yeah. So that's why I say that it's it would be beneficial for you to be present, especially in the exercise, but also during the lectures. So this was more or less for now about the technicalities. Well, we can also mention the... it's not present any longer, Piazza. So before we had this as an option here, but apparently it's not there any longer. So forget about Piazza. So if you have, for now, if it appears, I'll let you know. So it was a forum, a kind of forum for the students to communicate problems that they meet and discuss between themselves and with the teacher. However, for now, it's not present, even though they have announced that Piazza would be used again. Well, what can we do? In that case, if you have any question during the semester, you can send me an email. So the mail is myname.mysurname@ntnu.no. And my name is Slobodan Petrović. Yeah. Okay. Now, we can start with the science. The first topic is about classical cryptography. Maybe you have met some of these concepts, especially in the subject. You are all from the technology track, aren't you? Or forensics. For technology track, it's compulsory, this subject. We have a subject in the first semester of this master's program, which is called Introduction to Information Security Technology. Yes?
I heard a while back ago you said the exam date was
9th of June.
Yeah, well, on the NTNU website, it says it's on the 30th of May.
Ah, I don't think so. I think it has been moved. But I'll check that. There were some discussions because some people had another exam the same day. So I'll check that. You're right. You're right. I have seen that. But I have received the examination plan in a file, and there it says 9th of June. Well, anyway, before the end of this course, you will know the exact date. So for now, I know about this problem. Yeah. But thank you for warning me, because it might be that they didn't update, or they didn't update me. Maybe 31st of May is the correct date. Yeah. But you will have anyway. We are going to be to finish with the lectures before the Easter holiday, which means you will have 2 months for preparation of the exam. So you will have quite a long time. So I don't think it will be a problem whether it is 1 week before or 1 week after. Okay, so as I said, in the technology track, there is a subject in the first semester of the master's program called Introduction to Information Security Technology. In this subject, some elements of cryptography are also present. So you may have heard, if you have attended that course, about RSA, for example. Well, we are using RSA every day. So some concepts, but you will see in this course we are getting deeper into all that. Okay, we start with the classical cryptography. By classical cryptography, we mean the cryptography in, let's say, pre-theoretical period. So that's before the end of the Second World War, approximately. So in those times, cryptography was used. But the fundamental concepts that are theoretical nature, they were not developed. So, or at least they were not published. So the first actually paper that you can find about cryptography that is public, you will find here. And on this, we'll base some of our discussions today. So this Shannon's paper, Communication Theory of Secrecy Systems. So in this paper, Shannon, in 1948 or 1949, he explains why some ciphers are unbreakable, for example. And we are going to explain that today. But first things first, we say what is cryptology, what is cryptography, what is cryptanalysis. So the whole subject is called cryptology. Well, that has a Greek origin. Cryptos is secret, and logos can mean many things in Greek. I don't know Greek, but they say in the books that it can mean a word or language or meaning or science or whatever. It's science of secrecy, we can say that. So cryptology is science of secrecy. Now, it consists of cryptography and cryptanalysis. Okay, so cryptography is where we develop ciphers, so we make ciphers. And cryptanalysis is breaking ciphers. So, briefly said. Yeah. So, cryptography develops methods of encipherment to protect information, and cryptanalysis breaks these methods to reconstruct the original information. So, of course, if you don't know the key, we are going to see that key is the key, which means that the secrecy lies actually in the key. So if you don't know the key, then you cannot get the original message. Now, if you want to get the original message without knowing the key, that's cryptanalysis. So you have to break the cipher. That's how we call that. Now, if you want to prevent cipher from breaking, you have to know cryptology. Well, cryptography. Well, consider a communication channel. Two parties communicating. One party wants to send the message that is called plain text in cryptographic terms. This plain text has to be concealed in some way for the enemy, let's say. So this third party that doesn't know the key, that she cannot find this information open on the communication channel. So this is a communication channel. What we send through the communication channel is called ciphertext. Okay? So we have to transform the plain text to this ciphertext that is like garbled words, so nobody can understand anything just listening to that. And on the receiving side, we have to reconstruct the plain text. How can we reconstruct the plain text? We know the algorithm for decipherment, that is called decipherment, or sometimes in the US literature you will find decryption. So British is decipherment, and American English says decryption. So in the books you will find both. I accept, of course, both. So why am I not using the term decryption? Because in cryptanalysis, the process of reconstructing this plain text without knowing the key is called decryption. So in order not to mix, we are going to call the legal reconstruction decipherment and illegal reconstruction decryption. Okay? So, the party A wants to send the plain text to the party B in a concealed way, in such a way that the third party that is not allowed to know this plain text cannot reconstruct it from this information that is sent through the channel. It's called ciphertext. Now, how can we achieve that? We use an algorithm for encipherment. Sometimes in the US literature we find encryption. So encryption and encipherment is the same. Okay? Then the secret information here is the key. In some crypto systems, this key is delivered to both parties in advance. So both A and B have this key in advance before the communication starts. Now, by using this key and the encipherment algorithm, the plain text is transformed into ciphertext. Then its ciphertext is sent through the communication channel, and on the receiving side, the party B uses the decipherment algorithm and the key that was present previously to reconstruct the plain text. Now, the third party that is not in charge of knowing the plain text, she will try to reconstruct the plain text from the ciphertext and maybe some additional information, and this process is called cryptanalysis. It may or may not be successful. Usually it's a complex task. Usually it's very, very difficult to reconstruct this plain text without knowing the key. And that's the goal of cryptography, to make this process difficult for any party not knowing the key. Now, if it is successful, then the cryptanalyst, that's the person that performs cryptanalysis, it's called cryptanalyst, gets the information, and then the cipher system is broken. That's how we say. So this is the general cryptographic procedure. Now, there will be some variations of this process. We are going to discuss them when we talk about public key cryptography. So where we have the situation in which one part of the key is not necessary to be present in advance on both sides, which is practically very useful. However, you will see that these systems are not guaranteed to be secure or secure enough for highest level of secrecy. Okay, we can classify the crypto systems roughly into two categories. The symmetric key cryptography, which is more or less this. Okay, so we have the same key that is sent to both parties in advance. And such a system is called symmetric. So symmetric key cryptography, where we have a secret key, or sometimes it's called secret key cryptography. So we have a shared key that is secret that is delivered to both parties in advance. How do we deliver this key to both parties? By means of what we call secure channel. Now, secure channel in the old times, it was a truck full of paper tape that was delivered to both parties, and they used teletypewriters, and you will see how it was done by 1980s. So not long time ago for my age, but maybe for your age, long time ago. Anyway, it was not so long time ago that it was all electromechanical. And then the computers became massive, and then we have computers doing this, and the means of delivering this secret key has changed. We use USB or whatever. So that is now much easier, because before it was physically heavy, all these systems. Now, these symmetric ciphers are further divided into two categories. One is called stream ciphers, and another called is block ciphers. We are going to explain that a bit later. But they are both symmetric. Now, another category, which is a bit different from this, is called asymmetric ciphers, or asymmetric key cryptography, or public key cryptography. You have, of course, all heard about that, because nowadays it's used everywhere. So banking, whatever. Public administration, they use that massively. So what we have there is a secret key and a public key. You see, but this secret key doesn't need to be transferred by any means. So we'll see that there are algorithms that actually allow for this secret key not to be physically or by any means transferred from party A or some central party to both parties. Instead, it is generated in advance on the receiving side. It's possible. For some systems, they are based on difficult mathematical problems. Problems that are not possible to solve without knowing some piece of information that is called trapdoor. We are going to talk about that a lot, at least 3 weeks about this. So we have this secret key and the public key. Public key is much like a telephone book number. So it's a directory where we have unique information assigned to each participant in the communication. And that's called public key. Everybody knows that. But without knowing this secret key, even though you can intercept the ciphertext, you cannot reconstruct the plain text. So ideally, it would be impossible at all. However, these heavy mathematical problems on which these systems are based are not difficult enough, you will see. The big advantage of this system is that the secure channel is not needed. So we don't need this channel through which the information about the key is delivered to both parties in advance. Now, what about stream ciphers and block ciphers? For now, we concentrate on these symmetric systems. So what is a stream cipher? This algorithm, this transformation, is applied to every symbol of the original message. For example, to every bit, if it is a binary signal, let's say, every bit is transformed by means of a stream cipher. Block cipher, we use a group of symbols, like 128 bits, and we encipher all of them at a time. For example, AES, everybody has heard about that. It has a block length, that's how it is called, of 128 bits. So that was basic concepts in cryptography. So we have learned what is cryptology, what is cryptography, what is cryptanalysis. We have learned the general cryptographic procedure, these algorithms, the processes, how they are called, encipherment, decipherment, or decryption. Decryption, which is actually reconstruction of plain text without knowing the key or breaking a cipher, Then we have learned something about classification of these systems into symmetric and asymmetric, and the classification of symmetric into string ciphers and block ciphers. Now, at the moment, we leave all that and we talk about history of cryptography, so-called classical cipher systems. From the very beginning of literacy, of using alphabets, the cryptography was present, of course, in a primitive way. However, you will see that some of these ciphers that have been used through centuries can be made very powerful, actually, but people didn't know how to do it. That's why they implemented the ciphers in the wrong way, and that's why they were broken, all of them. Now, we can start with transposition. What is transposition? It's just a permutation of letters of the message. So we don't touch the message, we just permute the symbols. So we use a fixed permutation. The fixed permutation is the key. Okay? So it's like a block cipher. So a primitive block cipher. You, for example, you have a message of length 20 and you have a permutation of length 4. Then you group every 4 letters, and you use this permutation on each of them. So the same permutation. So that's like a block cipher. The block cipher does the same. Of course, the transform is not just a single permutation, but it's much like that. How can we actually break such a cipher? We can use statistics, but not the statistics of single letter. We use statistics of two letters, so that's called bigram. We are, of course, not going into details. You can play with that. You have actually a paper in this doc section of classical cryptography on breaking transposition ciphers. So if you really want to break one, you can use this. Is like 100 years old, but it's very efficient. You can break a transposition cipher by means of that. Of course, these ciphers are not used any longer. It's just illustration. Here is an example on the slide 7. Let's say that we have this permutation. So one goes to the first symbol goes to the fourth position, the second symbol goes to the third position, the third symbol goes to the second position, and the fourth symbol goes to the first position in every 4 tuple. Okay? So we have a plain text, classical systems. You see, very often in cryptography, we don't use space, we don't use full stop, etc., etc. We just omit these symbols because the plain text is understandable without that, and we save some bits of information by omitting these unnecessary symbols. So we say classical systems, then we have to group this message into 4 tuples. So CLAS, that's the first one, and we use the transposition, the permutation. So the first symbol goes to the fourth position, so here. Okay, so C goes to the fourth position, the second symbol goes to the third position. Here, the third symbol goes to the second position, and the fourth symbol goes to the first position. So we have obtained sulk instead of class. Then we say CK, LSYS, and TEMS. Okay? If it is not divisible by the length of the permutation, the length of the plain text, then we add some dummy symbols. So no problem. Okay? So what we get is garbled plain text. So it's not easy to get to reconstruct the plain text just looking at the ciphertext. So that's the goal. Of course, if we use a longer permutation, it will be even worse. So if you want to break the cipher, the first step is, and it is the case in many other cipher systems, as you are going to see, you have first to determine the length of the permutation. So how many symbols are garbled at a time? So once you do that, it's much easier. Then, of course, the brute force method, that's how it is called, is to try all the possible permutations. However, the number of possible permutations grows very fast. It's n factorial, where n is the length, and n factorial grows faster than exponential function. So that's difficult. However, you don't have to do that. You can use statistical methods. Yeah. So this is enough for you to know about transposition. It's not a very strong cipher. A much better is substitution. And we start with the bad one, the monoalphabetic substitution. That's a cipher that is easy to break. So, the same plain text symbol always has the same substitution symbol. So you permute the alphabet. You don't permute the message. You permute the alphabet. And one permutation of the alphabet is a key. Now, if you have an English alphabet is 26 letters, you will have 26 factorial keys. It's a lot of keys. You see, one would say that it's a strong cipher. If you want to try all the possible keys, then you have to try all the permutations of 26 letters, which is not possible in practice. So that's 26 factorial, you will see it's a very big number. But there are larger numbers in cryptography as well. However, it's too big for manual or even computers of today to try all 26 factorial. However, this cipher can be broken by statistical means, and you are going to see how. So this is a bad cipher. A good one is polyalphabetic, which means that each occurrence of the same plain text symbol, for example A, is substituted by a different letter. And which letter will be used for substitution of the next plain text symbol depends on the key. So you will see, these ciphers are of course very old. You will see that they have been used. For example, these monoalphabetic ciphers, we are starting with Caesar's cipher. That's before the New Age. And polyalphabetic, that's from, let's say, some of them. The good one, you see the Wiesner cipher, for example, it's from 16th century. Okay, so we try with the bad one, with monoalphabetic substitution, and here is an example. So you see, you take the alphabet, A, B, C, D, F, G, etc., etc., until Z. We are talking English, so we take the English alphabet, 26 letters. So we permute the alphabet, you see. So one permutation is, for example, this one. That's one key. Now, A is substituted with a P, B with L, C with O, D with K, etc., etc. You see, that's our monoalphabetic substitution. What does it mean? Whenever you have an A in the plain text, you substitute it with a P. For example, this is an example. This is our plain text. Now, A here is substituted with the P, and here also with the P. You see? So every time we have an A in the plain text, we have a P in the ciphertext. Obviously, the statistics of the letters in the plain text is preserved, which is very bad, which means you can find by knowing the language and which letter is the most frequent in the language, you can find what is its substitution. And today in the exercise, you will see that it's very easy to break this cipher, especially if you have a computer. Because after a couple of letters, you can reconstruct the message even though you don't use these frequencies of letters. You can use the intuition to reconstruct the words. So the more letters you know of the plain text, the better it goes. And faster, you reconstruct that easily. What we get is the ciphertext from this process, which is like something like that. Now, of course, the permutation will not help you, but counting letters will help you to break. This will, of course, not work on short messages. However, on longer messages, it will work. That's why this cipher is bad. It's easy to break, especially with the computers. Even worse is a special case of this cipher, which is called shift cipher. And the special case of the shift cipher is the Caesar cipher with the constant shift. See, what's the key? This is the alphabet. You see, this is Roman capital alphabet. You see, they have 23 letters, not 26. So in the original form, the Roman capital letters, it's the alphabet of 23 letters. It doesn't matter. We can use the English alphabet, but this is the original form, you see, of Caesar's cipher. So we shift the alphabet by three positions to the left, which means A is substituted with D, B with E, C with F, etc., etc. So they go in the natural order. It's just moved by three positions to the left. So A, B, C goes to the end. And then we can substitute A in the plain text by D, B by E, C by F, etc., etc. That's easy to do. However, it's easy to break because the shift is constant. And the shift is actually three. Everybody knows that. That knows Caesar's cipher. So you get the plain text. You just shift the alphabet to the right by three positions and you get the plain text. That's easy to break. Now, how can we mathematically represent such a transform? You see, the operation modulus something, maybe you have heard of that. Well, you sum in this case. A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, etc. That's one of the possible encodings, and that's the simplest way of encoding letters, and we'll use that. So you take A, for example, is 0, 0 plus D. So A, D is 3. Yeah? Then you have Z is always 3. The key symbol is always 3 for Caesar's cipher. So take A from the plain text, it's 0 plus 3, it goes to 3, to D. And then 1, that's B, plus 3, that's E, obviously. 2 is F when you add 3. Then to decipher, you subtract 3. But modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. Modulus means once the sum overcomes 23, we divide by 23 and take the remainder. Okay? And you will see that if you have a negative number, you have to be very careful about that. We'll use this operation many times. So modulus operation is very, very important. Now, if the shift is not 3, that's called shift cipher. You can vary. You can have 4, 5, 6. But the original cipher that was used in practice was Caesar's cipher. So Gaius Julius Caesar, he used it in the first century of... No, it was first century before our age. I think so. 40-something years. I'm not very good in history. But that's it. Now you can change the shift and you get shift cipher. That's a variation on the theme, on the topic. This is obviously worse than monoalphabetic substitution because here you have how many possible keys? You have the cardinality of the alphabet, say n, factorial. So if you want to guess the key, you have to guess between n factorial possibilities. And usually, well, it should be that they are all equally likely. So you took the key at random. Now here, what is the number of possibilities for shifting? If you have the alphabet of cardinality n, you can shift n minus 1. You have just n minus 1 possibilities. Well, n if you want to use even the shift 0. But you will have just n minus 1 possibility. That's much smaller than n factorial, obviously. So guessing the plain text in this way is also very easy. So the number of keys is small. Well, these were monoalphabetic substitutions or monoalphabetic ciphers. They are bad because of the statistics and especially this one, the Caesar cipher or shift cipher whose number of keys is small. So you can even break it by trying all the possible keys in practice. That would be crazy because you can do it easier by using the shift, for example, in Caesar cipher. The shift is constant, so you have just one key. Well, it worked 2,000 years ago. People didn't know. Now, a good cipher is polyalphabetic cipher, but the implementation was bad, and that's why it was broken. So we are going to discuss two possibilities, Wiesner cipher and the Bofor cipher. They are very similar. Bofor cipher has some advantages, but just in practical realization. But theoretically, its security is the same. So Wiesner cipher. You see, in the Caesar cipher, we have this. The ciphertext, Y, is the plain text symbol plus the key symbol modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. Here we have the same. You see, if we have English alphabet or whichever alphabet of cardinality N, in this English case it's 26, in Norwegian 29, so we have that the ciphertext symbol is obtained by summing the plain text symbol and the key symbol modulo 26, modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. Now, what is decipherment then? Well, just subtract. So you subtract the key from the ciphertext and you get the plain text. Subtraction modulo n can give you negative number. Now, what is negative number modulo n? If you use any computer programming language, it will always give you wrong result, because they just take the absolute value modulo n and then add, well, remove the minus. That's wrong. So what you have to do is to add n to this negative number. So modulus of a negative value is computed by repeatedly adding the base, which is in this case 26, until you get a positive value. That's extremely important, otherwise you make a mistake. Now the encoding will be A0, B1, etc., etc. So this is our alphabet, and you convert it into numbers by substituting each letter with an integer. Now, why is this cipher better than this one? Because of the key. Key is a randomly selected letter, well, a word consisting of, say, N1 or M letters, which are shorter than or equal to N, which is the length of the message. Of course, in the past, in 16th century, they used a table to compute this. So how do you use the table? You see, the first row is the alphabet, the second row is the alphabet shifted to the left by 1, the third row by 2, by 4, etc., etc. You have all the shifts of the alphabet. Okay, 26, counting the first one, which is the alphabet itself. Now, how do you encipher? You take the plain text symbol, say P, you take the key symbol, say L, and intersection gives you the ciphertext letter. Easily. Encipherment is easy. Now, how do you decipher? You know the key, and you know this letter, the ciphertext. So you have to search for the ciphertext letter in the key column. And then the first letter of the corresponding row will give you the plain text. So that's how you decipher. You cannot see that very well. Okay, so this, in this case, it's L, if you don't see it well. And this is P, and the intersection is A. So in the L column, you look for an A, which you have received as the ciphertext letter, and then the first letter in the corresponding row where you find the intersection will be the plain text letter. And you do that for every symbol of the ciphertext that you have received. Of course, if you do it by hand, it's difficult. Oh, it's very, very dull process. If you have a computer, it's easier to use this one. And of course, they used wheels, they used all kinds of implementations of this cipher. one cipher that uses actually the same table, if you want to implement it, but it's a bit different in the sense that the operation is different. It's not plus, it's minus. You see, it's the Bofor cipher. The Bofor that invented the wind scale as well, you have all heard of him. So he lived in 19th century. So he actually improved the Vigenère cipher in the sense of implementation. And why? Because you see, if you instead of summing modulo 26, well, modulo the cardinality of the alphabet, you subtract from the key, you see? So I'm subtracting the plain text symbol from the key symbol, modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. Now, if you want to decipher, then you use the same operation, you see? Subtraction of the ciphertext symbol from the key symbol. Which means you can use the same device for encipherment and decipherment. Which, if you have wheels, it's very handy. See? That's why Bofor cipher is actually the foundation of modern ciphers. And this such kind of cipher is called involution. Because it uses the same operation for encipherment and for the decipherment. So involution is very useful. Let's have a break. 10 minutes. Okay. Thank you. Okay, we can continue. So we stopped at Beaufort cipher. So as we have seen, you use the same operation for encipherment and the decipherment, which is very useful for practical implementation. So you use the same operation, and because of that, if you have devices, for example, to realize that, you use the same device for encipherment and decipherment, unlike the Vezhnev cipher, for which you need two devices. One implementing the sum and the other one implementing the subtraction. And the quality of the cipher or security is not affected by this. So you just do more or less the same kind of things. And of course, if you want to use the table, you can do it, but in a bit different way. So for example, if I want to encipher the letter T, and the key letter is W, you see? What I do is searching for the key letter, W, and then the first letter in the column that is at the intersection is the ciphertext, you see? And at in decipherment, I have received D, I looked for W, and then I get T, you see? So, if you want to implement this cipher by means of a table, then you have two searches. You have to search when you encipher, and you have to search for the key letter when you decipher. Now, recall the Vezhnev cipher. When you encipher, you don't search. You have the letter of the plain text, and you have the letter of the key, and then you don't search. You get directly from the intersection the ciphertext letter. But when you decipher, you have to search for the ciphertext letter, which means that this cipher is faster if you implement it with the table. So because here when you encipher or encrypt, you don't use search. Search is slow. And when you implement the Beaufort cipher with the same table, you have to search for the key letter when you encipher, and you have to search for the key letter when you decipher. So it's slower than Vezhnev. However, what you get is, if you don't use the table, if you use wheels or something, there were many such devices. Then you use one device for both operations, Encipherm and Decipherm, which is great advantage. Well, that was before the long texts had to be enciphered. And why is that? Because if you have to encipher a page of text or a novel, you will need a lot of manual labor for this. Even if you use wheels, mechanical devices, this will take a long time, and it's an error-prone process. Once you make one error, then you may spoil the rest of the message. To this end, a kind of automation of this process has been attempted, and that was in the end of 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. They started using rotor machines, of course, with the appearance of electricity used in everyday life. So these rotor machines, they implement not just one operation. They implement many operations applied one after another. Okay? So it's a multiple polyalphabetic substitution realized in hardware. Rotor machines, why? Because they contain wheels. And each wheel has two sides, and you have contacts that actually correspond to each letter. And then you have contacts on the other side that correspond to each letter, but the wiring, the connections, actually realize permutations. So each wheel realizes a monoalphabetic substitution. So the wiring determines which one. And you have some wheels moving each time you press a key on the keyboard to encipher, and some wheels do not move every time. So you have some notches on these wheels that determine when the next wheel will move. So that makes the substitution very complicated in the end, the total overall substitution very complicated to reconstruct. Some wheels do not move at all. They are called stators. And this moving of wheels is called non-uniform moving, because some wheels do not move each time you press a key. There were many such rotor machines, of which the most known one is the Enigma machine. It's the German cipher machine from the Second World War. It was actually invented by the end of the First World War in 1918. However, since it was the end of the war, it was not used, and it was improved in the period between two world wars. And then it was heavily used or intensively used by the Germans during the Second World War. There were two variants. One was with three rotors, that's for the army. And one was with the four rotors, that's for the Navy, U-boats. They used that machine. It was more complicated to break. Now, in this machine, Enigma machine, you have an entry wheel, that is a rotor. It turns by one position, 1 divided by 26, because you have 26 letters of the alphabet of the circle at each key press. And you have two other rotors in the army version. They are called, so this entry wheel is called N wheel, and the two others are called L and M. They do not always move. It is determined by these notches. Then you have a stator, which in Enigma has the role of preventing substitution by the same letter, which is actually bad, and it was the reason why the machine was broken by the British. But why did they need it? Because they wanted the involution. They wanted the same machine for encipherment and the decipherment. If you allow the substitution by the same letter, then you have a short circuit. So it's a current flowing through the machine. Okay? And then if you allow this, you have a short circuit, so it will not work. That's why this reflector actually reverses the flow of the current back to the, you will see, lamp board. So how does it work? You press a letter on the keyboard of for the plain text, for example, an A, and then you have lamps, and each lamp actually corresponds to one letter. So you press an A, and the lamp, for example, B lights, then you write down the B. That's the ciphertext. And then once you type the whole message, you get the ciphertext as letters, and then you use radio telegraphy to use Morse code to send this information through the air. So that's how it worked. So this reflector was actually necessary in order to avoid having two machines. So one machine would then be needed for encipherment, and the other one would be needed for decipherment. Okay? Now, if you don't want two machines, if you're just one, then you have to prevent short circuit, and because of that, you have this reflector, which actually makes the statistics bad. It's a small bias. However, it was exploited. So there is never substitution of A with an A in ENIGMA, or B with a B. Now, during the Second World War, well, during the development of the machine, in addition to this principle, these rotors, they also added so-called plug board. It's a wired permutation of letters. For example, you type an A, and the machine behaves as if you have typed an S, for example. So it changes what you have typed. The other part is the same. So it complicates more the cryptanalysis. And on the slide 17, you see the principle. So you press the key A on the keyboard. Now, the current flows. You see here you have a battery. So the, it's a one-way current. You know? So the current flows this way. So it goes through this permutation, this plug board, and from this point on, after the plug board, the machine behaves as if you have typed S or some other letter. It depends on these connections. Now, it goes through the entry wheel that realizes one monoalphabetic substitution. And this substitution is determined by the connections from one side to another side of the wheel, the wires. Then you have another wheel, M wheel and L wheel. They do not rotate every time. So you have some notches on this wheel. When the notch touches the notch on this wheel, then this wheel also moves, but not all the time, etc., etc. And then you have the reflector in which you reverse the flow of the current. So it goes back through the same wheels the other way. Otherwise, it would go the same way. That would be the short circuit. That's why if you cannot substitute A with an A. If you can, then the current goes the same way, you have short circuit. No? That's why. So you need the reflector. Now, one permutation, another permutation, another permutation. So each wheel realizes the permutation of the alphabet. And then the plug board, again, through some wiring, and then you get a light on one of the bulbs. And you write down this letter that lights. So this was broken because of this small bias that was introduced. So ENIGMA is a famous machine. It was massively produced. It was a military secret held by the kept by the British until 1977. Nobody knew that they broke the cipher. And they sold the machines. I know that they sold it to Spain. So Spain had a lot of ENIGMAs even after the war, and they used them, without knowing that it was possible to break. And then you have the famous book by David Kahn, The Code Breakers, about this Bletchley Park. Everybody has heard about that. The movie was made about this, not just one, several. One with Kate Winslet, it's interesting. Okay, so you can see the movie, I think it's on YouTube somewhere. Okay, so this is a bad cipher. The conclusion is that it's a bad cipher, it was broken, and the British say that it was decisive for the outcome of the war, which is, I think, too much. But anyway, it's important. Now, a better cipher, also rotor machine, is the Venom cipher. It's called one-time pen. We are going to see why. It was invented more or less at the same time as Enigma, but it is based on a different principle, which is better. You know, teletype writers, have you ever seen one? It's a big machine, 50 kilos of iron, and you have a typing part, and you have a paper tape, and you have paper roll, you see? As you type, you see the text on the paper, like typewriter machine. But you have a paper tape punch that at the same time realizes a code. And the most often used code is 5-bit code called International Telegraph Alphabet Number 2. So it has been used for 100 years. This was the basic means of communication of text until 1980s. So every news agency had one. Well, one, many. Like NTB in Norway, they have this. Now, of course, they are all replaced by the computers, but since the beginning of the 20th century until the end of the 20th century, these machines were used. Now, for these machines, this guy, Venom, the engineer from US, he invented a machine that was capable of encipherment of teletype writer symbols. The key is a binary random sequence whose length is the same as the length of the plaintext. Super important. The key is random, as we said. It was used only once. That's why it is called one-time pad. Once you use one part of the key, you never use it again. Also super important. The transform is the sum modulo 2 bit by bit, or XOR, exclusive OR. Exclusive OR, for those that don't know, or that have forgotten, it's binary. You see? So you have 0 plus 0, that's 0. 0 plus 1, that's 1. 1 plus 0 is 1, but 1 plus 1 is 0. See? That's XOR. Exclusive OR. So you see? That's the operation. Now, since it's a sum modulo 2 bit by bit, it has another advantage that you can use the same transform for decipherment. That's why this is involution by definition, which is very good. So you use one machine for encryption and decryption. You see, it was a mechanical add-on to the teletype writer. This add-on, you see, you have one tape and you have another tape with the key. On one tape, you type your message. And as you type, you get the text on the roll of the paper, but also you have this text encoded in 5-bit code words on a tape. And then you use the device that performs the sum modulo 2 bit by bit of two tapes. And you get another tape that is the ciphertext. Then you send the ciphertext by means of the same teletype writer. You just read the ciphertext, and it is converted into the pulses of current on the line, and on the receiving side, instead of typing that's just garbage, you use the device that performs the same function, plus modulo 2 bit by bit, getting the key tape, which was delivered to both parties in advance. That's a symmetric cipher. And then the ciphertext tape, summing modulo 2 bit by bit, gives the plaintext. And then you read the plaintext from the tape. So tape is very important. How did this look like? It was a tape. You have small holes. It's used to lead the tape through the device. There was a kind of wheel that was moving the tape. And now you have 5 bits, 3 bits here and 2 bits here. You see? If you have a hole, I think that's a 1. If you don't have a hole, it's a 0. I'm not quite sure. It may be the opposite, but it's a kind of that. And it's an international telegraph alphabet number 2 that was very often used. There are other alphabets, but most of them are this ITA 2. So this has been used for ages. This cipher is unbreakable, and we are going to show why. Of course, if you obey the rules, so you have a random sequence for the key that is used only once and whose length is the same as the length of the plaintext. Now, we are going to see why such a cipher is unbreakable. This is called perfect secrecy or theoretical security. Perfect secrecy, that's by Shannon. So you will see in that paper how he actually explains that. So a cipher system, informally, a cipher system is theoretically secure or perfectly secret if no attacker with unlimited time and computational resources can break it. So imagine, say, this monoalphabetic cipher, we have 26 factorial possible keys. Imagine that you can actually enumerate all of them, and if you, after doing that, still don't know which plain text was used, then it's a perfectly secret cipher. So even if you can enumerate all the possible keys, and the number of keys grows at least exponentially, you will see in this Venom cipher, for example, 2 to the power of the length of the message, it's a very big number after several letters, you see. Very big number of possibilities. Even if you can enumerate all the possible keys, after that procedure, you still don't know which plain text was used. So how is it possible? We are going to show. Now, that was informal. Formal definition. A cipher system is perfectly secret if the plain text is statistically independent of the cryptogram or ciphertext. So if you don't know the key and you want to break the cipher, what you get is the cryptogram. And if you want to decipher, it's called ciphertext. It's the same information, but the evil party, the third party that is not allowed to know the plain text, they don't have the key. So what they are analyzing is the cryptogram. So the plain text is statistically independent of the cryptogram. What does it mean? The probability that a particular message was sent if a particular ciphertext was received is the same as the probability of the particular message before sending the cryptogram. So knowing the cryptogram will not help you at all, because the message doesn't depend on it statistically. So no information is obtained by receiving the cryptogram. Well, the question is, okay, this is nice, but how can we achieve this? We can achieve it this way. Exactly one key transforms each plain text to each cryptogram. You will see an example. And all the keys are equally likely. Well, obviously, if one key transforms each plain text to each cryptogram and all the keys are equally likely, so there is no favorite key, then even if you can try all the possible keys, you each time get an understandable message. So a meaningful message. So you get, if the number of keys is, say, 1 million, you try 1 million keys, on your cryptogram that you have received, and each time you get a meaningful message. So which one was sent, you don't know. So that's the idea of perfect secrecy. Well, in practice, if you have a cipher system with the plain text space, the ciphertext space, and the key space, that is 0, 1 to n minus 1 to the power of n, which means this big N is the number of letters of the alphabet, and this small n is the length of the message. So, if the message, the ciphertext, and the key are of the same length, you see, and they are all from the alphabet of cardinality n, with n letters, and all these keys from the space Z are equally likely, so there is no favorite key. So there is no key that is more likely to be chosen than the others. And if you use the transform, you see, the ciphertext message is ciphertext is obtained by summing modulo n, big N, the cardinality of the alphabet, symbol by symbol, the letters of the plain text and the symbols of the key. If you do that, then you get, if n is 2, for example, 0 and 1, it's called random cipher. But otherwise, it's actually, you see, this is a Wiesner cipher. You see? So there it was 26. So it was y was x plus z modulo 26. You see? Now, if you use modulo 2, then you get random cipher. Then this is XOR. And if not, if, for example, Wiesner cipher, then it's modulo 26. Why is this unbreakable? Because in the Wiesner cipher case, the length of the key was shorter than the message, and the key was not random. That's why I said it was wrongly implemented in the centuries before 20th century. However, if you extend the length of the key to the length of the message in Wiesner cipher, and you use a random key used only once, that's unbreakable. Very interesting. So Wiesner cipher is actually perfect. However, it was wrongly implemented in practice. So a cipher system whose length of the plain text and the key are the same, whose key is chosen at random, it is actually perfectly secret. Now we are going to show how. Here is an example. Say that we have length 2 messages. Okay? So what are the possibilities for the key? 00, 01, 10, and 11. What are the possibilities for the message? 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And consequently, what are the possibilities for the ciphertext? Also, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. You see, the key thing here is that the number of messages that are meaningful, that means something to us, is the same as the number of keys. So, say that I want to encipher 0, 0. If I use the key 00, then I get the message Y1. So it will be, if you have some modulo 2 bit by bit, it will be 0 plus 00, 0 plus 00, so I get 00. Okay, here. Now, if I want to encipher 01 with some key, if I encipher 01 with 01, I get 00 again. Then 10 with 10, 00 again. 11 with 11, 00 again. You see, because 1 plus 1 is 0. That's XOR. So I can obtain this 00, this ciphertext, from all the plain texts. So if I can try all the possible keys, of course with 2 bits it's piece of cake. So I try 00, I receive just that. I don't know anything else. So I received the cryptogram, which is 00. So I try the keys. I try 00, I get this message, 00. I try 01, I get this message, 01. I try this one, I get 10. I try this one, I get 11. So which one was sent, I don't know. even after trying all the possible keys. So we can repeat the experiment for Y2, Y3, Y4, it will be the same. So that's the point. The point is that if you have the same number of meaningful messages as the number of keys, even if you have tried all the possible keys, you still don't know which message was sent, because all the messages that you get are meaningful. Such a cipher system is perfectly secret, obviously. Now, what's the problem in practice? The problem in practice is that not all the messages are meaningful. You see, our language is very redundant. So if we speak any language, French, English, Norwegian, whatever, I can encode with a relatively small number of bits all the meaningful messages. If I have more bits, then most of the messages that I can encode with them is meaningless. So they could never be sent. So once I receive a cryptogram that originates from a real language, not this one, this is very artificial, that all the messages are meaningful. So if I receive such a cryptogram, then I, even if I can try all the possible keys, then I'll get some candidates for the message. Some of these reconstructed messages will be meaningful, but some of them, or most of them, will not be meaningful. Now, usually I don't get just one meaningful message in this process. I get several. These several, if I have a lot of bits, these several messages can be millions of messages. Now, the question arises, after which length of the message I get just one meaningful? So that's what we are going to discuss now. This may be a bit mathematically challenging, so please concentrate. Well, we have been talking about perfect secrecy. Perfect secrecy requires that X, the message, is meaningful. All the messages are meaningful. In practice, it's never the case. In practice, we have a practical security. A cipher system is practically secure if an attacker with limited time and computational resources cannot break it. Why is this important? Because the number of possibilities actually grows exponentially with the length of the cryptogram. If I have bits, just binary digits, and I have 100 bits, 100 doesn't look so much. However, the number of keys of length 100 is 2 to the power of 100. You see? It's variation with repetition. So, in combinatorics. So, this is 10 to the power of 33, approximately. So, you will never be able to enumerate all the possible keys with any hardware or any computers in parallel, even with that. And you can imagine 1,000 bits or 10,000 bits. So one page of text, that's 2,000 symbols. Each of them can be encoded with, say, only ASCII code, that's 8 bits. So that's 16,000 bits per page. You will never enumerate all that. So that's called practical security. Before we assume that you can, in theory, enumerate all the possible keys, in practice it's never the case, which is fortunate. Otherwise it would be easy to break any cipher. Now, we would like to compare the cipher system. Which one is more secure than the other? For this, we need a measure of security. One possible measure would be like this, if you have too many keys. Okay? So a desirable property of a cipher system would be that a cryptanalyst should not be able to decrypt the cipher by trying all the possible keys. When is that the case? When this number is too big. However, this measure of security is not always appropriate, because this number, to be big, that's necessary but not sufficient condition. Because you can sometimes break the cipher by other means, not by enumerating all the possible keys. So sometimes a cipher system may have internal weakness, which reduces significantly its resistance to practical attacks. In fact, when we discuss cryptanalysis, we shall see that it's all the time the race between the cryptanalysts and the cryptsynthesists, let's say, in which the cryptanalysts actually try to reduce the space of the keys that they have to search. So sometimes we do not have to try all the possible keys to break the cipher. Sometimes we have to try a smaller number of keys. That's often the case. So a weakness is encountered or found in a cipher system, which actually reduces the possible number of keys to try from 100, 2 to the power 100 to 2 to the power 90, which doesn't mean too much, but that's reduction by 10,000 times. Okay? However, sometimes we do not have to try the keys at all. For example, we can use statistical methods to break the cipher. And we have already mentioned that when we talked about monoalphabetic ciphers, where we have a 26-letter alphabet. Each permutation of the alphabet is a key. So we have 26 factorial keys, which is this number. You can try to read this number at home as homework. It's a big number, but you will see in this crypto course we shall use much bigger numbers. So this one is considered relatively small. However, it's really big. 26 factorial is a big number. Now, suppose that you can check one of these 26 factorial keys in a nanosecond. So 10 to the power minus 9 seconds. So you try all the possible keys, and for each one you need this time, which is 1,000th part of 1 microsecond. So that's extremely fast. Now, if you have such a machine, you will need 10 billion years to try all the keys. So that's really a lot. Now, you cannot do it. However, we say that this cipher is bad. And why is it bad? Because I don't have to try all the possible keys to break it. I use statistics. So we have to count the letters. And we are going to show an example in the end of this lecture. So we count the letters of the cryptogram, and we compare the statistics of letters in the cryptogram with statistics of the language. And then we can find which one, which letter was the most frequent one and the next most frequent, etc., etc. We easily reconstruct the plaintext without trying any key. So this desirable property of a cipher system that would be that cryptanalysts should not be able to decrypt a cipher by trying all the possible keys is not enough. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. So we use a better measure of security of cipher system, but in order to introduce that measure, we have to introduce some concepts of information theory, like entropy, conditional entropy, so we are going to review that now. You have probably heard of at least entropy, Shannon's variant of entropy, which is a special case of so-called Rényi entropy. But anyway, we use Shannon's entropy. So we are going to talk about that now. So this new measure that we are going to use, not the length of the key as a parameter, security parameter, but something else. Consider an alphabet with n letters, say 26, and the key of length small n, say 100. Now you can imagine that you have a message and the key of length 100 from the alphabet of 26 letters. So that's something quite common. Now, possible messages, consequently, since we are using this system that uses some modulo n as a cipher transformation, we get the cryptogram of length n as well. Now, all the keys are equally likely, but the messages, as we said, are not equally likely. We have meaningful messages, which are very likely, and we have meaningless messages that are not likely at all. So probability is close to 0-0 for each meaningless, because who would encipher a meaningless message? It doesn't make any sense. So you usually, in practice, you always encipher a meaningful message. You want to transfer a meaningful message from party A to party B. So the messages are not equally likely, otherwise it would be a perfectly secret system. Probability of a meaningful message is very small, but it's much higher than meaningless message, even though it's small. And why is it small? Because we have 100 letters. So the total number of meaningful messages compared to the total number of messages is small. That's why we say that the probability of meaningful messages is very small, but it's much higher than the probability of meaningless messages. Now, suppose that the cryptanalyst can enumerate all the possible keys. Okay? So remember, it's not the case that we had before. Before we had all the messages equally likely as well. So all the messages meaningful. However, here it's not the case. After trying all the possible keys, the cryptanalyst will get some meaningful plain texts. But most of them will be meaningless. So you can try that at home. You encipher something with Vernon cipher or whatever, and you try to enumerate all the possible keys, and you will see that after a certain number of trials, you will get some meaningful messages, but you don't know which of them was sent. Now, if you have this number of possible messages, and you try all the possible keys, you may get like 10 million meaningful messages. So you didn't do the job, so you still don't know, even though it's smaller number than 10 to the power 33, it's still impossible for you to say which of these meaningful messages that you get was really sent. Now, as n grows, the length of the message, you will see that the number of these meaningful messages after trying all the possible keys is reduced. And consequently, after certain length of the message, you will have just one meaningful message after trying all the possible keys. So this length, n0, we can call it, is called unicity distance. So how long message we have to intercept, how long cryptogram we have to intercept in such a way that after trying all the possible keys, you get just one meaningful message. So that's our measure of security. So this is called unicity distance. And call it n0. So how can we determine the unicity distance? We need entropy for this. So Shannon's entropy, we start with that. So what is entropy? You have a set of possible events, and each of these events has an associated probability. Of course, we are talking about discrete case. It's interesting for us. Well, if you have to choose, then you choose the event with the highest probability. Okay? That's quite natural. Now, if you don't have just one element with this highest probability, then among those that have equal this highest probability, you choose at random. That's the natural way of selecting things. Now, what's the confidence with which the cryptanalyst makes the decision? It depends on how much the probability of the chosen event exceeds the probability of other events. So if it exceeds it very much, then it's very confident. If it doesn't exceed it at all, then it's not confident whatsoever. So a quantitative measure of this confidence is called entropy. Sometimes it's called the measure of uncertainty of the system, which means the higher the confidence, the lower the uncertainty, which means the lower the entropy. What are the requirements for this entropy? It has to be positive function. If all the events are equally likely, then we have a purely random guess, and it's maximum entropy. So there is no confidence in the decision whatsoever. Whichever element you choose, the probability of this element is the same, so you are not sure of any choice. So then it's maximum of uncertainty. The opposite case is if one event has probability 1 and all the others have probability 0, then you are very confident or 100% confident if you choose this one with probability 1. So the entropy is minimum. Well, consider this function. Minus the sum of the probability of each event times the logarithm for the base 2 of the probability of each event. And minus, of course. And why minus? Because these logarithms are all negative. Because the probability is smaller than 1. Okay? So that's why minus. We want a positive function. Otherwise, it would be like this. Negative. So h of x, this function, satisfies the requirement for the entropy function. It reaches the maximum when all x's are equally likely. We are going to show this when we infer the formula for unicity distance. It takes the value 0 if one outcome has the probability 1 and the others have the probability 0. Now, of course, if you have probability 0 and logarithm probability 0, so this product, its limit is 0. So you use limits because logarithm of 0 is not defined. Well, for binary variable, the entropy function looks like that. If both sides of the coin are equally likely, then the entropy is maximum. It is 1. If one side of the coin is so heavy that it always appears when you toss the coin, then the entropy is 0. You know that it will be the outcome of the experiment. And the other way around, on the other side. If it is too heavy, that the other side never appears. So this is the simplest case, two outcomes of the experiment. If you have more, then it's not two-dimensional curve. It's a figure in n-dimensional space. But we are actually interested in binary case because most communication today is binary. Now, for the message and for the key entropy, if you have the probabilities of appearance of each of these events, one key or one message, then you have the corresponding entropy of the key and the entropy of the message. For our unicity distance, we also need what is called conditional entropy. You see, when you do cryptanalysis, you always have some information in advance, so-called a priori information. At least you know the language in which you know who your enemy is. You see, you know the language in which the messages are written. You know, for example, the time of day, when they start, something like that. So this is called information a priori. So we have already intercepted some material, and we want to know, given this information that we have, how confidently we can predict that a given message was sent or given key was used. So will this affect at all? So if not, then we don't have any benefit of knowing this information. Okay, so for any set of cryptograms, y, and any positive integer, which is the length of this cryptogram, we denote by yn the set of cryptograms of length n in this space y. So we take, in other words, we take all the cryptograms of the same length. So we fix some length, and we do all the analysis with that length. And then we try to generalize. Okay? Now, the joint probability that the plaintext x was sent and the cryptogram y was received, it's p of xy. And the conditional probability is the a posteriori probability, which means we have received the cryptogram, and from that we would like to know what is the probability that a particular message was sent given this cryptogram. So that's a posteriori probability. Obviously, it's conditional probability. And p of xy in general case is not independent, this y and x, and because of that, p of xy is the probability of the cryptogram times the probability of message given the cryptogram. Okay? If they are independent, it's just p of y times p of x. However, we are not that lucky. So in fact, in most cases, they are not independent. Now we can define our conditional entropy by using conditional probability. Okay? So for the message, the conditional entropy of the message, this is sometimes in Shannon's terminology, is called equivocation. In Latin, it's error. Equivocarse, it means commit an error. So we'll call it conditional entropy. So conditional entropy of the plain text given the ciphertext or cryptogram of certain length, n, is given in this way. The joint probability times the logarithm of conditional probability of x if y for each x and each y of certain length. Or if we substitute p of x, y by this, p of y times p of x if y, we get, well, a transform formula, which is more practical. Now, the same way we can define the conditional entropy of the key. Just use another letter. It's the same formula. So we need that. Now, we are ready to compute the unicity distance. Recall the experiment from before. We have X messages, Y cryptograms, Z keys taken from the alphabet of length N, and whose length, the length of these messages, keys, and cryptograms is small n. Now, the cardinality of these spaces is obviously big N to the power of small n. So, for example, if we have two letters, 0 and 1, it will be 2 to the power of the length of the message. That's how many messages we can make. Now, this, if we use logarithms, we can substitute this N to N to by 2 to the power of R0n. We shall need that, where R0 is the logarithm of n, but for the base 2. So we use all the logarithms for the base 2 from the secondary school. You know that logarithm of x to some base, let's say 2, is logarithm of x divided by logarithm of 2. That's what we need, because on calculators we have logarithm for the base 10 or for the base e, but not for the base 2. So to calculate the logarithm for the base 2, we need this formula. Now, of course, it doesn't apply only for the base 2, but we need the base 2. So it can be 3, then it will be logarithm x divided by logarithm of 3. That's something that is very easy to prove. You have used that in secondary school. Now, then this R0 we substitute by logarithm of the alphabet, cardinality of the alphabet for the base 2. And then this possible number of possible keys, messages, and cryptograms will be 2 to the power of, we would like it to be 2 to the power of something. So that's why we use this transformation. It will be 2 to the power of R0n. So we have 2 to the power of R0n plain texts of length n. And of course we can divide it into meaningful and meaningless. All the plain text in the meaningful group, they have approximately equal probabilities, which are much higher than the probabilities of meaningless plain texts. Okay? Because we never use meaningless plain text, of course, in practice. Now, the number of meaningful messages, we can also represent it by means of logarithms to 2 to the power rnn, you see, where this rn is much smaller than r0. Now, we are not going into details, but it can be shown that if you have this conditional entropy of x given the messages of the cryptographs of certain length, divide by n, you get this rn. And this is called rate of the language, this rn. It's the entropy of the plain text source per symbol. So you just divide the conditional entropy by the length of the cryptogram. So that's called the rate of the language. But remember, everything is now analyzed for the length that is fixed. It's length n. We didn't generalize for all the lengths. Now, obviously, by definition of probability, the probability that a plaintext chosen at random is meaningful is the favorable outcome is that it is meaningful. The probability of that, the number of these meaningful messages is 2 to the power of Rn n. And the number of all messages is 2 to the power R0n. You see? So this is the probability that if you pick a plain text at random, that it will be meaningful. You see? Now this Rn is much smaller than R0, because the number of meaningful messages is much smaller than the total number of messages. Now, obviously, you can transform this formula into 2 to the power of this minus this. So Rnn minus R0n, and after elementary transforms, you get this. 2 to the power of minus n times, you see the difference between R0 and Rn. Now, it's very important to notice that it is required that all the keys are equally likely. Okay? So there is no favorite key. Which means decrypting a cryptogram Y by trying all the possible keys leads to a random selection of plain texts. So after trying all the possible keys, you get some plain texts that are meaningless. You discard them, but you will get certain number of plain texts that are meaningful. And you still don't know which one was sent. So the probability of obtaining a meaningful plain text in this process is exactly this. 2 to the power of minus n times R0 minus Rn. Now, how big is Rn? It's small. It's very small in any natural language, for like English or Norwegian or whichever. Very small compared to all the messages, compared to this R0. And this is called this difference here, R0 minus Rn, that's called redundancy of the language. So each language is very redundant. And in our examples with perfect secrecy, redundancy is zero because all the messages are meaningful. So there, R0 is the same as Rn. So it's quite artificial. It never happens in practice. There is no language that is that perfect. So a high redundancy of the language is something that designers of crypto systems don't like. So they would like the system to be as with as low redundancy as possible, because that would approximate their system to a perfectly secret system. Unfortunately, in practice, it never happens. So every natural language is very redundant. So this difference exists. And you will see, actually, for some languages, they are determined. How are they determined? You take a lot of, it's called corpora. So a lot of texts, they say a Bible or whatever, and you count the letters, count the symbols, and you will determine this in experimental way, empirical way. So, the probability that a plain text of length n chosen at random is meaningful is 2 to the power of minus n times the redundancy, because the redundancy is this difference, R0 minus Rn. And if all the keys are equally likely, I told you when we define entropy that you will see the maximum entropy there. So H of Z will be by elementary transformation, so Pi, they are all equal. All the probabilities of all the keys are equal, and the probability of one key is 1 divided by n to the power of n. Big n to the power of small n. So small n is the length of the key, and big n is the length of the alphabet. So if you substitute, you have here 1 divided by n to the power of n, logarithm 1 divided by n to the power of n, and how many elements in this sum, you will have exactly n to the power of n, because this is the number of keys. And this minus, and then this disappears. Then you have minus logarithm of 1, minus logarithm of n to the power of n. Logarithm 1 is 0, so you have minus minus, you have plus, and you have logarithm of n to the power of n. This is the entropy of the key, if all the keys are equally likely. So you can try that at home, it's very easy to get. So, by definition of logarithm, n to the power of n is 2 to the power of h of z. So n to n we can substitute by 2 to the power of h of z. Now, what is the expected number of meaningful disaffirmations when we try all the possible keys? We try all the possible keys, that's n to the power of n trials. And at each trial we have this probability of getting the meaningful message. We have already seen that. Well, we multiply. And what we get is n to the power of n, n to the power of n is 2 to the power of h of z by this. So 2 to the power of h of z times the probability of meaningful message, 2 to the power of minus n times the redundancy. Well, by definition, we have 2 to the power of this minus this. So 2 to the power of h of z, you see entropy of the key, minus the n times the redundancy. N is the length of the key, the message, and the cryptogram. When is this equal to 1? That's the question. When it is equal to 1, then this n will be n0, the unicity distance. So we are asking ourselves, when, after each, which n will this number be equal to 0 and this number will be equal to 1? Just one meaningful message after trying all the possible keys. Well, it happens when the entropy of the key is the same as n times the n, the redundancy. Now, of course, this analysis holds for fixed length of the message. Now, if we vary the length, what happens? Will this hold for each n? Yes, it will hold, and it actually tends to a constant, this Rn. So the rate of the language tends to a constant. This constant is called R, and it's called the true rate of the language. Which means we can remove this index, n. Well, then we have d instead of dn. D is general, and it will be r0 minus this true rate of the language, minus r. Now we can compute the unicity distance. So when is the number of meaningful messages after trying all the possible keys equal to 1? Well, we take the entropy of the key that we can compute because we know that all the keys are equally likely, so it will be logarithm of the total number of keys divided by r0 minus r. r0 is determined from the length of the message, and r is the true rate of the language, which is empirically obtained. And for English, we shall use in this course this value, 1.5. In the books, you will find the values between 1.5 and 1.7. So it varies. It depends on which kind of text the authors have determined this number. Now, for a theoretically secure cipher system, N0 is infinite, which means you will never, even if you try all the possible keys, you will never get just one meaningful message. And we are going to show that computationally in the exercise today. But this requires that R0 is equal to R, because then this logarithm divided by infinity gives, divided by 0 gives infinity. So we don't have redundancy in this case. So R0 minus R is 0. So all the messages are meaningful. That's what we have had today when we talk about perfect secrecy. If all the messages are meaningful and all the keys are equally likely and the keys and the messages are of the same length and each key is used only once, then it's a perfectly secret system. In practice, of course, there is redundancy, and because of that, we are going to consider an example of monoalphabetic cipher where the number of keys is 26 factorial. the cardinality of the alphabet is 26, and we take Hellman's value for the rate of the language, true rate of the language, which is 1.5. So we use the formula directly to determine this N0. So we have just inferred this formula, we obtain that, and we are going to apply it. So big N is 26, small n is, you will see, not needed, and then R0 and R we are going to show. So all the keys are equally likely, then the probability of each key is obviously 1 divided by the number of keys, 26 factorial. So use formula for entropy, and we get the entropy that is logarithm of the total number of keys. So we have already shown that. So it's logarithm of 26 factorial. So it is possible to obtain on a calculator, and it's 88.4. And then D is the difference between the redundancy of the language, of course, is the difference between R0 and R. R is 1.5, and R0 is logarithm of the length of the key. So it's logarithm of 26 for the base 2 minus 1.5, that's 4.7 minus 1.5, that's 3.2. Now by formula we have to divide these two things, 88 divided by 3.2, so we get 27.6, which means in practice if you take intercept just 28 letters of the cryptogram, 28, and you try all the possible keys, you have 26 factorial keys. So imagine that you try all the possible keys, because you cannot do it in practice, then you will get just one single meaningful message, and you will know which message was sent. This is very small number, 28 letters. It should be as much as possible. So this unicity distance should be very distance, if possible, infinite. If it is infinite, then the system is perfectly secret. We are going to show that today in the exercise. Now, maybe we have talked too much in this class. What do you think? We started at 12:10. Ooh, it's already 1:15. Why didn't you warn me? You need some rest. Okay, let's have a 10 minutes break and then we continue our lecture.
Written exam. Before we have.
Okay, it works. Thank you.
sont généreux. Je me demande si c'est vraiment précipité quand même, les gens sont généreux. Ah, parce que, ok, je sur un mois, c'est plus ou moins cyclique. Quoi.
Non, non, c'est parce que la coupe, on a fait avec le Damson, qui a eu aussi une structure qu'on shift à droite des 16.
C'est l'ensemble de la police, ou tu veux.
Moi, ça, c'est le plus de l'ensemble.
Ah, ça, c'est utilisé pour shift, quoi.
Ouais. Et vu que c'est le doc qui est la pêche.
Okay, we can continue. So we have seen how we can compute the unicity distance, and we have seen that it is a nice measure of security in the sense that it has discovered for our bad example, monoalphabetic cipher, that it is not secure because we only have a very small number of characters that we have to intercept, for which after trying all the possible keys in theory, we would get a unique message that is reconstructed. That's actually not desired. We would like this N0 to be infinity. Because if it is infinity, that means that no matter what we try, if we try all the possible keys, it will not help us to find the meaningful message. All the messages will be meaningful. So that was about unicity distance as a measure of security. You will see that it is important. And now we are going to consider how we can break monoalphabetic and polyalphabetic ciphers. Polyalphabetic ciphers, we can break them if they are not very well implemented. Like Wiesner cipher in its original form, it's not well implemented. And because of that, it's not Wernham-like cipher. So it's not perfectly secret. So we first illustrate how we can break monoalphabetic ciphers, so substitution ciphers. So the statistical properties of the plain text are obviously preserved in the ciphertext, because if we all the time substitute the same letter with the same letter of the key, then the number of the substituted letters will be the same as the number of the original letters of the same type. So the number of A's, if they are substituted always by a P, we count the P's and it will be the number of A's, actually, in the original message. So this is what is exploited in the attack. How can we exploit that? We actually compare the statistics that we determine on the cryptogram with the language statistics. And the language statistics are known. They are determined also empirically on very long texts. The most often exploited properties of any language are the frequency of letters. These are called monograms. So we count letter by letter, but we don't have to count just letters. We can count pairs of letters, triples of letters. So they are called n-grams. So b-grams, 3-grams, 4-grams, etc., etc. Sometimes it may help, because, for example, to break transposition cipher, we have to count b-grams. Now, let's count the monograms. That's the simplest thing. So we break monoalphabetic substitutions this way. For example, for English, the letter statistics can be found in many books, and this particular statistic, it varies a bit between the books. So if you take this book from 1982, they provide these statistics. For E is the most frequent letter, it's 12.7%. T is the next one, then A, then O, etc., etc. The rarest one is Z, 0.07%, then Q, X, J is very rare, for example, in English, K, etc., etc. So T, H, it's from the articles, T, H, E, that's very often used in natural language. So you will see that these frequencies apply. So if you know that the text was written in English, you usually know the language of your enemy, then you can exploit this. For Norwegian, which is interesting and not very often found in books, so you have these statistics. E is the most frequent letter in Norwegian as well, but the next one is N and R, unlike English. You see? And then you have T, you have S, I and L, A, D and K, just 5%, and here in English, A is 8%, so it's clear difference. G and O, and then M, F, P, U, and V. For other languages you find in corresponding books, it's known for every language. Now, how can we exploit that? Let's consider an example. Monoalphabetic substitution, and you take one permutation of the alphabet, 26 letters, and that's our key. The plaintext is, the frequency of letters plays a great role in cryptanalysis of monoalphabetic ciphers. You see, no spaces, no full stops, no nothing, just letters. And you can still understand when you read. Now, if you apply this monoalphabetic substitution, T is substituted by an E, H by U, E by N, etc., etc. So you apply that and you get this. EUN, etc., etc. So this is our cryptogram. There is no way of understanding at the first glance what is the original message. But we use statistics. So we count the letters in this cryptogram, and the most frequent letter is N. You see? N with 9 occurrences in this cryptogram. So we assume that N is a substitution for E, because we compare the statistics that we have determined on the cryptogram with this table. So E should be the most frequent letter. So we say by this, N should be the substitution for E. And if we check, E is really substituted by N. So we have guessed well. Now, this cryptogram is relatively short, which means that sometimes it will not work, this frequency analysis. So we need a longer cryptogram for this method to work, and usually cryptograms are longer than just one sentence. So in this case it works. So N is a probable substitution for E. And then we continue with the next most frequent letter, etc., etc. And this will work if the cryptogram is long enough. So no problem. So this is easily broken by comparing the letter statistics and the monogram statistics with the table of frequencies of letters for the English language. So today we are going to demonstrate a program on which you will see that you don't have to check the frequencies all the time. After you reconstruct several letters here, you will guess the words, etc., etc., and then the message is easily broken. What about polyalphabetic ciphers? The letter frequencies will not work, so they cannot be used for cryptanalysis because the cryptogram is randomized by means of the key. But the implementation is bad because the key by Wiesner cipher is shorter in general than the message. It's not random. It may be repeated. That's even worse. But the fact that it's shorter than the message, it will help us in determining the length of the key. Once we determine the length of the key, we can split our cryptogram in several parts, each of which will be not only a monoalphabetic cipher, it will be a shift cipher, very easy to break. You will see that. So this method was patented in 1863 by Kasiski. It's military cryptanalysis. So we first have to determine what is the length of the key. So the key is repeated, you see. How do we do that? We use autocorrelation function. What is autocorrelation? So you take the symbol, say this is our message, and then you shift by one, for example, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and then shift by two, shift by three, and then you count the number of agreements and disagreements, and that's called autocorrelation. So the correlation of the sequence with the shifted version of itself. When we find the maximum of this autocorrelation, that will be the length of the key. So the shift will be the length of the key. Then we can decompose or split our original cryptogram into simple monoalphabetic cryptograms. Actually, they are shift cipher, not only any monoalphabetic cipher, which would also be easy to break by means of this method, frequencies, but we don't have to do it. We do it for one letter only, and then it's a shift cipher. So all the letters are then reconstructed automatically. So, the problem of breaking a polyalphabetic cipher in this case, if it is not well implemented, is reduced to breaking K shift ciphers, where K is the length of the key. How do we break a shift cipher? We determine the shift. Okay, we can guess the shift, which is also easy. We have just 26 possibilities if we count no shift. Otherwise, it's 25. So it's also easy, but we don't have to do it. We use frequencies. We find the most frequent letter. It's the substitution for E. And then the others are F, G, H, etc. in this order. So that's easy. We have a program for that. We shall see that today in the exercise. So the key letter is then the code for X minus the code for E. A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, D is 3, E is 4. So everything is minus 4. And here is an example. You see, this is a cipher, Wiesner cipher. You see, this is the cryptogram. It is, this example is taken from this book. This book we have used before in our course. Now we are not using it anymore. We use another one. But the example is good. So, but you have to take the second edition. In the first edition of the, we have the same example, but we, there was an error. So they corrected the error in the second edition. So this is our cryptogram. So what is the key here? And what is the message, of course? Well, it's not, doesn't look easy. However, we use autocorrelation and we see that the length of the key is shorter than the length of the cryptogram. And that's the indication that is bad implementation. If you get the same length by autocorrelation as the length of the cryptogram, then no way. There is it's then Wernham cipher, generalized Wernham cipher, not binary, but it's Wernham cipher, perfectly secret. So in our case, with this particular cryptogram, we shift by 1, shift by 2, shift by 3, and count the agreements and disagreements, and we get the maximum number of coincidences, 24, for the length of the shift equal to 5. So shifting by 5 and then counting the number of letters that will be the same gives 24 coincidences, 24 letters that are the same in the original and the shifted version of the cryptogram. Which means that for this shift, we get the maximum, which means that this is probably the length of the key. The cryptogram is pretty long, which means that this is highly likely, that it is 5. So the length of our key is 5, with high probability. Now what we do is, we split this original cryptogram into 5 cryptograms for each letter of the key, which means the first one we take by we obtain by taking the first and then the sixth, so 1 plus 5 and then plus 5 plus 5 plus 5, so we get the first cryptogram. So we decimate this sequence. That's called uniform decimation. And then the second one, we take the second and the seventh and the 12th, etc. And then the third and the eighth and the 13th, etc., etc. So we get 5 separate monoalphabetic shift ciphers that are easy to break. So we illustrate breaking one of these. So in our case, we take the first, the sixth, the 11th, etc., position of the original cryptogram, so we get this sequence. So take the first, the sixth, so V, V, and then etc., etc. So we get V, V, U, T, T, C, C, etc., etc. Okay? Now we know that this is a shift cipher, but we don't know the shift. So how do we determine the shift? We can use the frequency of one letter. Okay? So we count the frequencies and determine the maximum. G is the most frequent letter here. So G is a probable substitution for E. Since this is a shift cipher, G is 6 and E is 4, so the key is 6 minus 4. It's 2 and 2 is C. So that's the first letter of our key. And we don't have to do anything else. You see? Because in shift cipher, the key letter, the key symbol is always the same. So you obtain this cryptogram by taking the plain text plus 2. So plain text letter V, 21 plus 2, you get 23. Well, if it were V, we don't know which one was plain text letter. But anyway, we obtain this by adding 2. And this one by adding 2, and this one by adding 2, because it's a shift cipher, it's not just any monoalphabetic cipher. In the case of Caesar cipher, we add 3 all the time. So our shift is 2. Now the second shift cipher is this, VVS, etc., etc. So we take the 2nd and the 7th and the 12th, etc., etc. So we have this one. We do the same. The most frequent letter is S, and after the computation, E is 4 again, and S is 18 from this table. 18 minus 4 is 14. That's the shift, and that's O. So we have two letters of the key, C, O, and we proceed this way. We get codes. So that's our key. And if we know the key, then we easily determine the plain text. The method used for the preparation and reading of code messages is simple, etc., etc. So you see, this is actually the plain text, easily obtained. Now, these small cryptograms, they may be too short for frequency analysis, that is exact. So to determine the shift, we can do it in two ways. We can try all the shifts. That's also possible because the number of possible shifts is small. So we can do that, but if not, we continue with the frequencies. If we get the wrong letter, then, for example, every second letter will be some garbage, then we know that this O was wrong. Well, or some other letter. So we then take the 2nd of most often. So not the most often letters as a substitution for E, but the 2nd most often. And if wrong again, the 3rd most often, until we get the right letter for the code, for the key. It's easy on a computer, so it's not a big deal. So you just repeat the procedure. And our program that you're going to see, it does just that. Now, why does this work? We have already seen that. We are just repeating. So since the key is shorter than the plain text, it has to be repeated, and that opens the way to the Kaczynski attack. So this autocorrelation then works. That's why it is called, the attack is called the incidence of the coincidence, which means how much we get, how many times we get a coincidence when we shift. So the Kaczynski attack is called the incidence of the coincidence. The second weakness is that the key is not random. It's, in this case, codes, which is a meaningful word. And this is how the cipher has been used for centuries. So that was really wrong. So it was shorter than the message, and it was repeated, and it was not random. So if it is not random, then you can use a dictionary attack. You see? So the meaningful words are more probable than the meaningless words. So you use the dictionary attack. So you can do it online. There are sites that do that. This. So nowadays, in 21st century, but in the 16th century, it was difficult. Now, if you use a random key that is the same length as the length of the plain text, then this will not work. So there will be no incidence of the coincidence. All the incidences will be the same. So what we get then is Venom cipher. It's not binary, but it's the principle is the same. It's generalized Venom cipher. So you can use Wiesner as you used 500 years ago and still get the unbreakable cipher. Now, we have to explain in the end one point that we mentioned before, and this is the fact that for one-time pad, that's why it is called one-time pad, you use the key only once. You use the key for enciphering on one message, and then you discard the key, never use it again for another message. Now, we are going to show what happens if we repeat the key. So, the misuse of the system is I use one key, and with this key I encipher the message 1. And then I use the same key, and with that key I encipher the message 2. So what happens then? How can we break such a system? Okay, so suppose we use the key K1 to encipher the plain text P1. That's okay. But we encipher another plain text P2 with the same key K1. Well, consider the transform. That's the transform XOR in binary case. So the first ciphertext or cryptogram is obtained by summing modulo 2 bit by bit the plain text P1 and the key K1. Then we repeat the key, but we use another plain text. Remember, plain texts are not random. Okay? So we obtained another ciphertext. Now, ciphertext is sent to the line, so the enemy can listen on the line and get C1 and C2. So what enemy does, he sums C1 plus C2. What happens then? We have P1 plus P2 plus K1 plus K1. You see? Now, 0 plus 0 is 0. 1 plus 1 is 0. You see? So K1 disappears from that. You see? So then, the enemy knows C1, he knows C2. He doesn't need key at all. He doesn't know P1, he doesn't know P2, but P1 and P2 are not random, so this sum of C1 and C2 will be statistically bad. He can use frequency analysis, and especially if he knows, for example, the preamble of the message, he will be able to reconstruct directly the preamble of another message, so it is, because they are not random. So this is shown in the next slide. So C1 plus C2 is P1 plus K1 plus P2 plus K1, and this disappears because in binary K1 plus K1 is 0. So we have P1 plus P2. They are not random. The sum is, say, more random than the single one, but it's still not random completely. The sum of two statistically bad sequences has better statistical properties than each of them by itself, but still it's not completely random. So we get an expression that does not depend on the key, as if we didn't use the key at all. So that's why you never repeat the key. That's why we use the cipher that is called one-time fed. One-time means that. So you use the key, discard it, never use it again. Now, of course, if it is not binary, then we don't have to sum, we subtract. We say C1 minus C2 and we get the same. So we get K1 minus K1. It's easy. So we still get cancellation of the key. So the key disappears. So that will be all for this lecture. In the afternoon, after the lunch, we have the exercise in which we have the laboratory part. We are going to demonstrate some software. And we have some numerical part where we are going to compute, for example, unicity distance, etc. So please be there at A154 at 3:15. The third one is missing, but I'm sure that I have. I'm sure that I have pressed the key for recordings. We shall see that. If it will not be present in the Blackboard Collaborate, then you will have the reserve, this Omnom. It's still working. So hopefully it will work.